Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine that we swear did not just name Elon Musk Man of the Year. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Good morning, all.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk in a moment about an egregious governmental attack on the free press. But first, do you find it nearly impossible to keep up with the news without going crazy? Thwarted by paywalls, misled by clickbait, trapped in a cycle of doom scrolling. Well, picture an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out fake news and trashy listicles while showing stories from multiple perspectives to counteract confirmation bias. Where you can find some positive news, little hidden nuggets unearthed from around the globe. All this and more is available from an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg, creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best-of newsfeed. You can get more than $12,000 of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go right now to Inkle.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount. So that's a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just 75 simoleons. Go to inkl.com/podcast today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Britain's High Court last week ruled that Julian Assange, the 50-year-old Australian national behind WikiLeaks, could be extradited to the United States, where he faces an 18-count indictment of violating the 1917 Espionage Act by publishing classified U.S. documents related to national security. If convicted on all charges, Assange could receive a maximum of more than 170 years in prison. Catherine, the Freedom of the Press Foundation called this ruling an alarming setback for press freedom in the United States and around the world, representing a notable escalation in the use of the Espionage Act in the war on whistleblowers that has expanded through the past several presidential administrations. End quote. Are they right?
Totally right. This is something that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, but the idea that press freedoms are reserved for some special class of people who somehow prove that they are either real journalists or ethical journalists, which are two different categories, I think we can agree, that is nonsense. We have a bunch of evidence from really any direction you want that, you know, the framers intended for the First Amendment to protect everything that was written down and, you know, by extension, TV, radio, internet, whatever, that there is not, they did not intend to create a special protected class of journalists and then accord them extra rights. I'm happy to be, if there is such a class, I'm happy to be a class traitor and give away my extra rights to everyone else, too, which is how it should be.
Nick, I see a lot of free press organizations, including the one we just quoted, and also the Committee to Protect Journalists, up in arms about this and issuing statements and the like. Don't see an equivalent kind of guild reaction, let's say, or professional reaction among journalists on Twitter and social media. You follow a lot of journalists there, I suppose. Do you see a lot of people outside the Glenn Greenwaldo sphere getting exercised about this extradition and prosecution?
No, you know, and I think there's, you know, that's a story in and of itself, is that and that it's Joe Biden and that it was Hillary Clinton before Joe Biden and Barack Obama who really went after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, because even though the first big burst of WikiLeaks material that came out in 2010 wasn't about a liberal democratic regime, Obama's regime, they really hated it because it showed a really bad side and an immense lying side of the war effort in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. And I think you still see that. A lot of people who are kind of mainstream liberals or progressives hate Julian Assange because he really made things uncomfortable for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton later. And, you know, that is telling, you know, because what Assange did is, you know, he received, or and WikiLeaks more broadly, they received documents that are you know, that are secret and confidential, mostly from governments, not always, but mostly. The real only question in all of this stuff is, are those documents legitimate or not? Because I don't understand how Julian Assange is being tried here. It is such an absolute abrogation of basic free speech and press freedom that it's kind of stunning, and that this has been happening for so long now. I mean, this is a man who has been destroyed. You know, you talk about a chilling effect on other people, but his life has been destroyed. He had a stroke. I mean, he's done. It's incredibly disturbing, and I find it really appalling that more journalists are not like, we really need to make it clear that this type of behavior of criminalizing people who get leaked documents that are accurate and then bring them to the attention of the world, that somehow that's criminal.
Peter, to Nick's point, Assange and WikiLeaks, in the first kind of tranche of releases that they did about the war on terror, some of that was Obama, some of that was, a lot of that was George W. Bush, and he was kind of hailed at the time by quite a lot of people as being sort of on the cutting edge of a new way of disseminating information and to counteract the excessive secrecy regimes that happen out there. One of the kind of Glenn Greenwald interpretations of the lack of interest, comparative lack of interest now in talking about him, is that, well, Greenwald was involved with the leaking of emails around the Hillary Clinton campaign, which a lot of people attribute to being decisive in the 2016 election. Do you think that interpretation is fair? And even if it's half fair, what does that say to you about the kind of professional or ethical principled mores of the fourth estate? Is it fourth? Fifth? I always forget. The 17th estate. Peter, what's it?
You're so greedy. You want to be all the estates.
Counting is hard, I think, especially for journalists.
Thank you.
But speaking
Birds,
of journalists.
Not real.
Right. I mean, I think it's notable that all of this is happening as journalists have been in a frothy rage about, yes, a frothy rage, right? You can, like a latte
wow.
of rage.
That sounds like a cocktail.
About now.
The breakdowns in democratic norms, right? But a cornerstone of American democracy is that people should have the right to criticize the government and to publish true information about what that government is doing, especially when that true information reveals that the government has been lying or misleading or propagandizing about something really serious like a war effort. And so prosecuting someone for releasing damning information about a government war effort is, I think, a breakdown in government norms that is being ignored. And I think it's probably fair to say that at least part of the reason, maybe not all of it, maybe not even the majority of it, but at least part of the reason is that the Assange story doesn't fit any kind of conventional partisan narrative. And so I think this stuff is useful. The concerns about breakdowns in democracy are in many cases deployed strategically towards partisan ends. And since Assange doesn't serve that, he is not being included in that story, even though if we are seeing breakdowns in democratic norms, like, this is part of it. This is one of them, and it has been happening across multiple administrations now for over a decade.
Catherine, should there be an automatic sunset provision on any law signed by Woodrow Wilson during World War I?
Yeah. I think that's a good retroactive idea. Once we get our time machine going and we take out baby Hitler, we can then go back and deal with that. I mean, you
teenage
know,
Hitler, maybe. I mean, just, babies. Yeah,
I'm happy to kill baby Hitler, as you all know, right. I'm pro-choice.
But can we abort baby Hitler, or would the religious right not be down with that?
Many people who aren't just the religious right would not be down with that. But let's talk about press freedoms, not abortion. So, I mean, people generally make bad laws during wars. That's a great rule of thumb. It's one reason I think that we should be worried about forever wars, because then we can forever be making bad laws. And we do. And we have. I was actually just looking at our own J.D. Tuchilli's writing on Assange. Tuchilli is like a Assange. He thinks this is an important story. He pitches Assange columns a lot. He wishes that we would let him write about Assange every week. But and he's not wrong that it's an important story that has lots of implications in the world. But he notes in his column today that Assange is facing extradition to the U.S. In a year when the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to two journalists for defying their governments by reporting news that those officials find inconvenient. And then he quotes one of the Nobel Peace Prize winners from, I think, 2019, saying, "I think the whole-scale dumping of WikiLeaks isn't actually journalism. A journalist sifts through, decides, and knows when something is of value to national security and withholds until you can verify that it isn't." And I just want to say, like, first of all, the whole fetishization of national security, again, like, there's always a desire to kind of grow the state under that umbrella. But also, if that's the marker of a good journalist, like, explain local news police blotters to me. Like, there are plenty of journalists who are just dumping whatever information they get from the government. And everyone says, like, yep, you did your job. Great work. As someone whose very, 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 very first job in journalism was at a local newspaper where I did the police blotter and I just transcribed a fax from the police department, I have some blood on my hands.
I mean, I think some of the complaints about Assange from journalists stem from the fact that he just dumped things indiscriminately, but some of it just stems from the fact that he comes across as weird.
He does, though.
Right? Like, no, that's true. And, like, this is something that we have to separate. Like, yeah, he seems like kind of a weirdo. I think that is a fair assessment of the persona that he projects publicly. I've never met him, right?
But, like, I think that's totally fair on the scale of like normie to weirdo, like, people are more pro Snowden because he's just like incrementally less weirdo.
He seems like a kind of normal nerd, and as a result, he also gave
the documents to journalists.
Went through normal channels.
That is another big thing.
Right. And so the fact that he seems like a little bit of a weirdo, plus there's just this sense amongst journalists that journalists like to propagate, that journalism should be kind of literary. And like there's like it's about information and about sources and about all that stuff, but it's also about sentences and like, you know, like the clever expression of ideas, and that all of this should always be done by editors in bad khakis and like some fast talking reporters in fedoras hashing things out in a bullpen. And okay, that's a completely legitimate way to think about journalism, but it's not the only way to think about journalism.
Well, it's, you know.
And just because Assange didn't follow that template doesn't mean that what he did is somehow illegitimate. And that, I think, is the implication, the subtext of a lot of the complaints about him that we have heard over the past however many years.
Yeah, I mean, the real question is, are the documents legit? And is the data or, you know, the information in that, you know, accurate as collected by governments or corporations or whatever? Assange was also pretty explicitly libertarian in an Australian kind of variant of it, so it didn't map exactly onto American stuff. That disarmed people. And as well as
the alligator Loki of libertarianism.
Yes, exactly. And he actually crocodile, you know, since he's from Australia, you know, that rankled a lot of people. But nothing like, he shouldn't be in jail because he didn't do journalism, right? And he shouldn't be in jail because he received stolen goods and put them out. Or that's what WikiLeaks does. The government is trying to say that he actually helped Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, like that, you know, he helped Manning hack into Pentagon computers. And that's just not true. But again, like, you know, it's mind blowing that people are acting as if getting more information about the government, you know, and the government lying to people is somehow a bad thing. I mean, it's a totally shooting the messenger here.
There's a couple of follow up points, Peter. One is that while I think that there's some truth to the, you know, he doesn't do narrative journalism, I think there's also a lopsided reaction when you compare him to someone else who didn't wear khakis and do traditional journalism, but was nonetheless lionized as a free speech hero. And by whom I mean Nick's close personal friend, Larry Flint, right? A guy who's like offering bounties to dig up sexual improprieties of various congressmen, and who just did all kinds of really foul things in his life, was held up as a hero because he was transgressive in a way that used to be valued on the left, and he targeted Republicans and prudes and people like
you know,
that.
I miss him every day, Matt. I miss him every day.
I know.
I just want to fact check. I think he did wear bad khakis.
Really?
There's a photo. There's like a famous photo of him wearing, I guess it's technically maybe a tan suit. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, see.
Yeah. That's all the difference in the world. That is a controversy.
Yeah.
A tan suit is the baddest of bad khakis. That's my hot take.
Catherine, there's part of this extradition hearing was about the Brits being squeevy, that's a word, about American criminal justice system. Like, they're worried that he's going to be sent into solitary confinement. And the American's like, no, no, certainly not going to do that. Not going to put him in. We don't do that very often here in America. What? Us?
Yeah, he's not a teenager, and, Matt. Come on.
Yeah. there's that. And there's also, like,
he's going to have to eat lunch on a bucket.
170 years. And granted, you know, if he was convicted on all of them, it wouldn't be 170. It'd be more like 67 or whatever, like the sentencing guideline is. But at some point, like, that's crazy, isn't it? I mean, it leads to the I'm just going to invoke Clark Neely every time from now on. But like the whole plea bargain justice system that we have, where 97% or so of trials never go to trial, or cases never go to trial, because they're like, hey, look, you can go to prison for 170 years. Or we'll lock you up in solitary for like five. What are you going to choose there, Julian? This, like, there's reason to say that we're squeezy about extraditing people to the United States. This is kind of a sick criminal justice system, is it not?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the fact that everybody kind of, you know, this Assange thing has been going on for a really long time. And I don't think you can underestimate in this and in many other things that there's a point where people just kind of want it to be over and start cutting corners. And so I imagine that the Brits have had those concerns all along. And at some point they were just like, fine, we will accept your piece of paper covered with lies. Here you go. Take him back. Because that's what they did. They accepted a piece of paper covered with lies. You know, we promise that we will treat him definitely totally like a person with dignity and, you know, someone deserving of basic physical and, you know, psychological comforts. But, you know, unless he does something bad to deserve it, and then this promise is null and void. I mean, that's what the agreement is like, pending perfect behavior by, as Suderman rightly noted, this weirdo, we'll treat him with human dignity. And that's not going to happen. Everyone knows it's not going to happen. And we're just proceeding as if that paper full of lies is enough.
Let's shift gears here. Our colleague, Robbie Suave, if that is his real name, this morning pointed to a new ABC News Ipsos poll. Is that, should we pronounce Ipsos differently? I feel like we should.
Ipsos.
Maybe like a shuh. Ipsos poll, which shows that.
I think you should say it like Bernie Sanders.
Ipsos.
Yeah, there you go.
Please, don't encourage him. Don't feed the bears, Peter.
Has become the number one. Inflation has become the number one concern among Americans. Woo, that was fast. And that 69% of us disapprove of the way Joe Biden is handling the rise in prices, which at last glance was up, I think, 6.8% on an annualized basis. So, Peter, is this just another example of the corporate media showing its anti-Biden bias in, you know, exaggerating what is a transitory phenomenon?
Yeah. So I don't think this is a transitory phenomenon unless you define transitory as a real long time. And that's not what transitory means. Now, words don't have fixed meaning. So, you know, maybe by the end of this current inflationary era.
By the end of this podcast.
Right. Transitory will have come to mean this decade.
There's going to be transitory inflation. Like, it's going to literally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the inflation is going to be with us for at least another year, and maybe for a while longer after that. I think it's, you know, it's sort of unclear exactly how long these things last when you're in the moment, right? And exactly, like, it's, inflation is something that is both difficult to predict perfectly, as many mistaken predictions about the nature of this year's inflation, but also about inflation a decade ago have shown us. And so, you know, you don't know exactly how it's going to go, but I think it's pretty clear that we are not just about to turn a corner to where this is going to go away. It is going to be with us for at least some number of months and possibly some number of years going forward here. And part of that is Joe Biden's fault. And I think not all of it. There are some things that are out of his control, and we attribute too much control over the economy to presidents in many cases. We just sort of say, oh, the whole economy, that's all your fault or all to your credit. And that is a mistake. At the same time, Joe Biden's first big act when he came into office was to pass a $2 trillion stimulus COVID recovery bill on totally unpartisan lines that almost everyone, including many Democratic economists, warned was just a huge overshoot. Now, they were saying maybe some sort of stimulus bill would be worthwhile, but something like a third of the size that they actually passed. And they said, if you pass this in combination with the $4 trillion that we spent under Trump the previous year, we will end up with accelerating inflation. And lo and behold, here we are 8 or 10 months later, and we have accelerating inflation. And then in addition to that, Biden has done something else that Eric Boehm pointed out on the website last week. Biden has kept in place many of Donald Trump's tariff policies. And what do tariffs do? They do one thing and one thing only. They raise prices. They don't make anything more efficient. They don't help anybody out. They don't make the movement of goods and services any easier or better for anyone. All they really do is raise prices on Americans. Trump put these tariffs in place. Biden has kept them in place in many cases. And so that is contributing to making things more expensive in a time when inflation is also doing that. And so Joe Biden isn't fully to blame for all of this. At the same time, his policies have made inflation worse. Voters are blaming the Biden administration for it. And what the Biden administration wants to do is say, hey, it's not really our fault, and look a blimp. And I don't think it's going to work.
Catherine, there's been a number of pieces, I think concentrated a lot in the Washington Post. Perhaps it was Dana Milbank. And if it's not, Dana, I'm so sorry. Your work is
he's good on everything.
So
he's the Ernest Borgnine of columnists.
Saying with a straight face that Biden is getting a rougher go in the national media than Trump did. Inflation coverage is part of that. And, you know, the reason that there's the feedback loop, the reason why this is now a large priority of Americans is that the neoliberals can't stop yapping about it in the centrist press. What are some of the funnest inflation splaining exercises that you've seen out there in the world?
You know, I've become a fan of the genre, of the inflation splaining genre, and that is not least because I, like many Americans, am sort of suspicious that maybe absolutely no one knows what's happening and why. Like, I think that there is this feeling when you read this commentary, it's the same feeling I have, you know, when I read commentary about the performance of the stock market generally, which is to say, you know, you have to spill words on this because people care about it. And sometimes non-experts are spilling dumb words about it. And so I think to the extent that the charge is, hey, we are suddenly seeing and hearing an awful lot of press coverage about inflation, that in turn makes people concerned and changes their consumption habits, and that may worsen inflation. I think in that narrow sense that charge could be true. The idea that it is somehow all a plot by the corporate media to get Joe Biden strikes me as flatly absurd. The idea that Biden is getting a worse go of it from the mainstream press than Trump strikes me as flatly absurd, not to say that both of them don't deserve just boatloads of negative coverage, and not to say that reason hasn't contributed to that, but
like a stuck cargo ship full of negative coverage.
They are the ever given Suez media strategy is upon us. Yeah, but I think that, you know, this is not an example of somehow like the corporate overlords conspiring towards some end. This is an example of the current dynamics of the way that our media works, which you might say are bad, but it's not a conspiracy. It's incompetence as usual.
You know, though, the two things that I've been following in the coverage, which, you know, kind of rankled me. One is the kind of Elizabeth Warren argument, which she uncorked over Thanksgiving when she was into her, you know, her annual beer in front of an Instagram video or something. But, you know, and she said that it was just
three
these corporations,
you know, Adams deep.
ShopRite and Foodtown and Kroger, you know, they just want to, you know, make their stockholders even richer. So they're just jacking up prices. An analog to that I've seen in a couple of places are that, oh, well, you know, this is just about supply chain issues. And, you know, the problem problem is that there's not enough stuff and there's a lot of pent up demand. And so that tends to, you know, demand gets, you know, goes big and it gins up prices. I'm always amazed when there's never a mention of the amount of federal spending and the way that the Fed has been creating money over, you know, really over the past 20 years, but certainly over the past two, as Peter was talking about earlier. And, you know, and when you have basically the same amount of goods and services, because you can't scale up production in a couple of months or even in a year that easily. And you dump
especially
in, you know,
40%. Especially in the middle of a pandemic that has produced a huge labor disruption.
Right. As well as also lining people with more and more money to spend. There's not as much, you know, there's not more stuff to spend it on. So, yeah, you know, Milton Friedman was famous for saying that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. That may be too overly drawn. But there is no question that if you're reading something about inflation and they're not talking about massive, you know, historic increases in the money supply, both by the Fed, but by the Treasury, you know, and borrowing money, they are not worth reading because that's the main part of it.
It's just notable that by September of this year, U.S. household wealth was at a record level. And that is not entirely, but heavily because of federal payments that have just pushed up household balance sheets.
Peter, yeah. Nick.
And then you go, if I may just, you know, you, what do you do in a place where you can't get any money in the bank saving it? So you're going to invest it in stocks and houses. There's massive housing inflation because the stock of houses doesn't increase that quickly. So you have more people trying to buy the same amount of houses and, you know, prices go up. Wow, what a surprise.
And people are eating at home more and right. And durable goods are, people are spending their money in different ways because of COVID. And so it's a lot more money chasing the same narrower set of goods while there is also a, you know, supply chain disruption and labor issues.
Peter, Nick and I are old enough to remember Gerald Ford's whip inflation now buttons.
Can I add
I read about
quick...
them in my dad's issues of Mad Magazine.
Yeah. Can I add a great moment in that, too, was when George Harrison visited the White House because one of Ford's kids was into George Harrison and he gave Ford a Hare Krishna button and Ford didn't have a win inflation. He didn't have a whip inflation now button on him like they had fucked up and he didn't have, he couldn't give it to George Harrison. So it's like
we
and it was
are
a dumb
people,
idea in the worst White House ever.
Or we are the people. Big difference.
Yeah.
Anywho, there, Peter. So that was, you know, Ford mid-70s. By the late 70s, there was a full-blown kind of populist revolt that was about taxation rising and inflation as well, to the extent that Governor Moonbeam, Jerry Brown, and in his second inaugural or second inaugural address in early 1979, talked about inflation as the pale horse of death.
Oh, so good. So good.
It's a really good speech. Go Google that phrase, research that phrase on the Reason website. So, Peter, my question to you is, are there any Democratic politicians out there who are prospects to be bringing back the pale horse of death? And if so, is his name Joe Manchin?
I want to read the like 1994 Neil Gaiman Vertigo comic series. Like that he's doing, like, you know, as a sideline while he's also writing Sandman, called The Pale Horse of Death.
Yeah.
Like,
I think I'm super excited.
Yeah,
I think
Catherine's told me about it. I think Joe Manchin is just absolutely the most interesting Democratic politician in Congress right now. And it just keeps being, I won't say that he's always great. So interesting is different than always good or I always agree with him. But he is someone who has just consistently said things that are essentially correct about the Democrats' economic plans for the past 6 months, 8 months, as the Biden administration has been, you know, pushing this giant Build Back Better agenda. And but, you know, he keeps saying, look, this bill is structured as a series of timing gimmicks. Look, inflation is really high and we've already spent a bunch of money. And if we spend a bunch more, that risks stoking inflation even further than that. Right. And my voters in West Virginia, who are not conventional Democratic voters, who are not the sort of Democratic progressive base, But in many ways are representative of a kind of American swing voter who is, you know, will vote for someone like Joe Manchin, but also will vote for someone like Trump in many cases. They are concerned about this sort of thing. And Democrats in Congress appear not to be concerned about inflation and appear not to be concerned about the fact that their bills are just, you know, a bunch of gimmicks and a bunch of handouts to interest groups that have then been restructured as gimmicks because they can't actually fit it all into the amount of spending that they want to have. And so Joe Manchin has basically been in his statements writing columns that with a small amount of editing could appear at Reason.com in a way that's really kind of remarkable. And yet he is also one of very few Democrats who is actually out front on this, because the bulk of the party is just lining up behind the Schumer, Pelosi, Biden sort of plan for this, which is everybody get on board. You're not all going to get everything that you want. But if we don't all do this together, no one will get anything. And Joe Manchin's the only one who keeps saying, well, maybe it would be better if we just didn't have anything at all.
I will close this part of the discussion by pointing out two bits during the early stages of my editorhood. One, I recommend very strongly a piece from, I believe it was Robert Samuelson, economist, writer for The Washington Post, called Lessons from the Great Inflation. I believe it was an excerpt of a book at the time, but he was sort of talking about a now forgotten history of American politics in which inflation was almost always the top or the second concern in public opinion polls for about 15 years there in the 60s and 70s, and how we're forgetting that lessons at our peril. The second one, as always, pursuant to, I think, Peter talking about, or Catherine, about predictions of inflation that weren't exactly so 10 years ago, was the inflation returns cover from, I think, 2009. And it didn't return. That was that prediction turned out not to be true. All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the day in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, similar problems? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable. to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Mark Meadows needs with his PowerPoint lawyering skills, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery. They'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out. Please, to visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today. You'll be glad you did. All right, keep emailing your great questions to roundtable@reason.com. This next one from Nicholas Fink, great name, echoes probably the most asked question that we got and didn't answer at our recent bonus webathon video extra episode of the Roundtable. And speaking of the webathon, just thank you so much, everyone, again, for your generous contributions and nice comments about the Roundtable and suggestions, some of which we have been and will continue to take up. Here goes the email from Nick. Liz Fink. I live in LA County. The new DA, that's short for district attorney, has taken a lot of heat for decisions he has made related to charging and sentencing, or rather the lack thereof, of relatively minor crimes. This is partially due to a sharp and very visible rise in property crime over the past year or two, including recent massive and well-orchestrated smash and grabs at shopping centers and the burglary-turned-murder of a prominent philanthropist. I fully support bail reform and other causes Gascon, who is the DA in question, has implemented. Does he have the right ideas but is in power at the wrong time? Or is it just human nature to take as much advantage of a system as we think we can get away with? Put another way, is the pandemic just making everyone crazy? Or are certain criminal justice reforms destined to increase crime regardless of outside circumstances? Catherine, what say you?
I would actually say a sort of third thing, which is that I think it's the right idea. I don't think it's the wrong time. I think that it's the wrong scope of authority for implementation. So what I mean by that is, you know, people like this DA are doing what they can do within the system that they have to try and make it more just. And I think in general, you know, moving away from excessive criminalization and very harsh enforcement is the right direction. However, you know, as a libertarian, but also I think this is a pretty broadly shared view that one of the really, really minimal roles of the state is to prevent theft of property, that is really like right there in the bottom of the pyramid of stuff that governments should do. And that one problem is that we are still using, for instance, massive amounts of law enforcement resources to go after people who are committing victimless crimes, both war on drugs stuff, sex stuff, all other kinds of things in that category. We have such an incredibly complex legal code, and the people who are making decisions about what to enforce and where are working within quite a sort of ridiculously overbalanced and broken system. I don't think there's anybody who thinks that the rational way to go about reforming our policing practices is to stop punishing property crime. But that is the lever that this man has to pull. And so he is trying to pull it. And this is happening in many places around the country. I don't think this is going to be our equilibrium. I think that this is a growing pain. I hope that this is a growing pain in a broader reform movement where we rethink how to prioritize law enforcement, where we choose the places that that we can say to private businesses and private citizens, you can rely on the state to do this. Other stuff is up to you. Because that's the other thing here is like right now we are in a situation with no predictability, right? If you said to every CVS in America, hey, you guys are responsible for your own security. Like shoplifting, that's on you. So hire a guard, do whatever you got to do. We will give you the legal scope to be able to enforce that privately. But instead, we just, in some places, unpredictably and unevenly stopped enforcing laws in ways that we had previously been enforcing them. And that is imposing a huge cost on these private businesses. I don't think that is forever.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt like...
You know, Gascon is also... Gascon, the DA in question here in L.A., is absolutely the wrong messenger for criminal justice reform. When he was DA in San Francisco, before L.A., property crime went up 40% on his watch during a 9-year run. Zach Weismiller did a fantastic video about Gascon, Cheza Bodine, and a couple of other progressive district attorneys who are, you know, trying to loosen up the system. And the same thing is happening in LA in a lot of ways. And there is something wrong going on. And I think this, everybody would agree. I mean, you go to a drugstore now and they have locked up things like deodorant and certain types of toothpaste at the local CVS in New York, where burglary, by the way, in New York is down. But everywhere in the country, I mean, you know, common everyday items are being locked up. That's a sign of some kind of dysfunction. I don't think it's necessarily tied to, you know, not charging cash bail to poor people and things like that. And we also need to keep in mind these high profile smash and grab kind of things are a predictable result of the limit of what you get charged with a felony for that kind of activity was raised in most places from, you know, $500 to like $1,000. So people go in. They know what they're doing. And the police should be focused on that kind of crime. This isn't even really a prosecution issue. The cops, as Catherine was getting at, are, you know, are distributed among a lot of different things. If the cops were tasked with keeping less things in order, they would be able to actually, or they, we could hold them responsible for actually snuffing out this kind of crime as it's happening.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I mean, this is a resource deployment issue because to me, the lesson of, you know, pretty much all of the last 20 or 30 years of criminal justice studies is that especially for lower level non, you know, sort of crime that isn't violent towards a person, the thing that matters isn't the harshness of the punishment, it is the regularity and the consistency of it. And so police need to be there and they need to be, they need to take action when there's property crime happening. And then the thing that matters isn't, oh, are we going to put this person in jail for 20 years for, you know, stealing a razor blade? The thing it can that person reasonably expect to do some time and to go through the system and have some punishment basically every time they commit a crime, right? And so if you can build that expectation of into, you know, the people who might be committing crimes, that is what reduces crime much more than what Mark Kleiman, I believe it was, called random draconianism, where people commit a bunch of crimes, and most of the time, basically nothing happens except maybe a parole officer will yell at them. And then every once in a while, they go to jail for 10 years. And that's a terrible way to sort of instill discipline in people who have issues, who are having trouble, who are making a decision or having trouble figuring out what they're going to do with themselves. And so the trick here is both for the stores and for just the crime control, the population, right? That it's not harshness, it's consistency. But you can't be consistent in enforcing property crimes if you also have police deployed doing a bunch of nonsense that isn't valuable at the same time.
I will say, I think there is a culture element here. And, you know, social conservatives will always chime in at this point and say, like, well, but the real problem is, you know, we haven't instilled values in our children and, people don't have the proper, you know, sense of decorum. And if everyone just went to church and didn't bowl alone anymore, then maybe
those baggy pants and that baseball hat's turned backwards.
Yeah, they need to pull up their pants, yeah. Right? Like, I the temptation is to be somewhat dismissive of that. I generally think for stuff like this that sort of structures matter, expectations matter, as Peter said and as Nick just said. But there is one kind of cultural piece here that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and I don't know how significant it is. I don't want to make the same mistake that social conservatives make of saying, like, well, what I really want is for everyone to go to church, and so I'm going to blame the burglaries on that. But I think the like dehumanization of corporations is like a weird thing that's part of this. Like I feel like the idea that like somehow no one is harmed when you steal from a CVS is more prevalent than it was historically. Now, I don't know how explanatory this is, in part because this does happen at mom and pop places too. And you would think that that wouldn't be true. But I think some combination of the thing Suderman just described, which is that people correctly believe that they will often get away with it, and also that people don't think it's wrong either from a kind of, you know, deontological, you know, Kantian perspective or from a harm perspective, and so can kind of justify the behavior. I think that there is some of that going on.
There was a Twitter account by a San Francisco local recently who went through a bunch of tweets justifying the smash and grab stuff that we're seeing out in San Francisco. And a lot of it was people who said, well, first of all, this is okay because no one's harmed, because there's insurance, because corporations aren't real. Second of all, it's okay because the people who are taking this stuff need it. And third of all, this is a political statement against capitalism. And so, again, I don't know how systematic this is and how deep that goes. I think it's probably more just that there sort of seems to be a general air of disorder. And in the way that like that riots sort of catch virally, right? Like it sort of starts with 2 or 5 or 12 people and then the whole crowd's involved in it. I think there's an element of that as well. But I do think there's sort of some mistaken thinking about whether or not this actually harms anyone that is at least underneath the surface of what we're seeing.
It's some kind of weird, like double sublimated broken windows fallacy.
Wow.
I want to clip that 5 seconds and just run it at the beginning and end.
I stand by it.
As someone who I believe in one of our year end or year beginning things last year, 11 and a half months ago, I think made some kind of prediction about how rising crime, in at least in certain categories, was going to provide a challenge for criminal justice reformers. I think that remains true. And the way to rise up to that challenge is to be honest about it. I have seen too many people. There's two things I would like to discourage people from doing. One is the people who are in favor of a lot of broadly the same criminal justice reform that I am, to stop saying constantly trying to contextualize their way out of what has been a pretty obvious spike in murders, for example, in most places over the last 18 months by like, oh, well, come on, it's much better than 1997. Like, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. You can say, hey, look, burglaries are down. Murders are up. It's a complicated world out there. You're not going to win people to your side by dissembling. And I see too many people doing that. And then on the kind of cop side, and I live in New York, surrounded by cops by definition, there's a blame bail reform for every single thing that ever happens. And sometimes it's relevant and other times it's just not. And work through the individual cases. Like there's the guy who, you know, ran his car and killed all those.
No, it was his car that killed those people, Matt. That's what headlines were.
You know, the guy did
it. A car involved killing.
And he should have been in jail. He had a rap sheet that was just horrific. He was being charged for yet another violent crime. Everyone immediately said, we must get down to the bottom of it, says person who is directly responsible for having him out in the streets. You've got to be able to work through those things and to see whether there's a law associated with it, whether there's a bad actor associated with it. And otherwise, be confident in and also, you know, realistic and reactive to the world changing at your feet. And too many people, I think, are eager to not do that and to demagogue this. But that's the history of crime politics. Speaking of crime politics, I wanted to get at least a quick note in here because there are at least two viral bits, photo sessions last week involving. Law enforcement posing behind seizures in mostly kind of drug war related things. There was police dog posing at Dallas's Love Field Airport. No, it doesn't. Peter, stop it. Just because it's a dog doesn't mean awe. They're posing next to $106,000 in cash seized from a 25-year-old traveler from Chicago. The woman, as far as we know, at least the last reporting, was never charged with anything, but they just seized the money because the money looked pretty guilty. Cops can do that through civil asset forfeiture, as we've been writing at Reason since 1989. The other viral image was a picture of four cops in Taneja, Texas, Nick's favorite place to visit when he lived in Huntsville, standing behind a stash that included two handguns, two bags of weed, two cell phones, some sandwich baggies, and a whole bunch of $1 bills. They're super proud of this. And a whole lot of people reacted. I was happy to see this on Twitter by saying, wow, what are you people doing? Why are you seizing things from people?
Like, why did they just like seize my purse? Like,
exactly. Especially the baggies. Those you need them for various things. I was on a radio show, Tommy Doherty, up here at WTIC 1080, who tweeted out, and I quote, "I should have listened to Reason a long time ago about civil asset forfeiture." This was about Nevada Highway Patrol officers seizing a veteran's life savings that we wrote about because we write about this every single month. So welcome, fellow kids, to civil asset forfeiture reform. Catherine, is there something that you would like to tell our newfound friends who are coming to this issue now?
Yeah, man. Like, get mad, bro. Like, be mad about it. This is absolute nonsense. We have indeed been reporting on it forever. I actually went looking. We have a story that I think we released online today or maybe yesterday by CJ Ciramella about a woman who all the money that she had saved for her daughter's quinceañera was taken and not returned for 2 years. And it's not a 17-señera, so that's messed up. 18-señera, I don't know how long it quite took to get it back. But I was looking when we were working on that piece at the kind of deep history of civil asset forfeiture. And I had, I think, known but forgotten that it's fundamentally some like Jones Act nonsense that actually originates during the colonial era with seizures of ships that were importing or exporting goods from British ports that were not flying the British flag. So actually, like, every Reason story is really the same story in the end. Like, they all come back to the same place. trade barriers are civil asset forfeiture, is prison reform, and we should, I don't know, I guess, like, please clap for our consistency.
Please clap, indeed. So let's get to our end of show, what we have been consuming in the cultural spheres. And Catherine, actually, do you want to lead us off as well here?
Yeah, what I'm consuming is also an obituary notice. Anne Rice died this weekend, and she, most famous for her vampire books, especially the book Interview with the Vampire, which was made into a movie in 1994. And if hypothetically you were a 14-year-old girl in 1994, that movie and those books might have made like a very, very strong impression on you. So I reread a big chunk of Interview with the Vampire this weekend. It's still good, y'all. I mean, it's the total lack of humor and irony in those books I had forgotten, because, again, I read them when I was a teen, but they are, I think they are like undervalued as a thing that kind of created this or sort of built upon this thing in our culture, the kind of emo vampire, which, you know, we have discussed in the sort of vampires versus zombies and vampires versus werewolves matchups. I will always be team vampire. I think we have Anne Rice to thank for that. And in particular, what her death brought back for me was a memory of probably being about 13 years old and being at a beach house where it was too cold. And so I just had to read.
So like 74.
And the two stacks of books I had were a giant stack of Anne Rice paperbacks and a giant stack of Orson Scott Card paperbacks. And if that's not how you get me, then I don't know what is, honestly. I'm also pretty bummed that it turned out she can die. Like, I was a little bit hoping that maybe she was a vampire. But yeah, RIP Anne Rice, who created a particular kind of, I think, largely female-oriented subculture that made emo more delightful.
I think there was some appeal for a certain type of young dude.
No, totally. Speaking about,
so I've never read an Anne Rice novel, but I loved the movie. And right, you know, is and I also think, like, the fact that her vampires were embodied by, like, dudes who, I mean, especially
Brad Pitt. Bankable stars.
Right, Brad Pitt went on to become, like, our generation's, like, oh, I wouldn't be that dude, right? For both good and bad reasons.
Yeah.
And no, so part of his prehistory before, you know, Fight Club and before.
Prehistory.
Yes, was part of his early was that he was. That he was a sad vampire versus Tom Cruise, who was always like the dick guy who, like, especially in that era of Tom Cruise, who, yeah, like, you want to, like, oh, you're like, oh, he's like the jock vampire kind of. And Brad Pitt is.
I really would have liked to have seen Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt.
I regret to say that's completely.
And so then you're like, emo vampire becomes Tyler Durden.
Who can mix great mixed drinks.
I mean, again, this is just a brief tour through my teen psyche. Yeah. And
no, Rice was huge. And that, you know, that whole, it all fed, because Interview with the Vampire came out in 76. And it instantly became a backdrop for, like, whole wide swaths of subcultures. And, you know, there wouldn't have been goth culture. There wouldn't have been. I mean, it was big for girls. It was big for gays. It was big for guys. Yeah, it's a really powerful,
like, basically
presence.
Anyone who knows that, like, the correct term, the correct verb for what happens to lace when it gets old is that it rots, like that right there. Like, that's. A whole lifestyle choice.
That movie had a great cast: young Kirsten Dunst and Christian Slater. Mm-hmm. So good in that movie.
Oh, he's the
he's
right.
Good, he's the everyman. He's like Ernest Borgnine. Yeah.
This is right after Heathers.
Speaking of Ernest Borgnine, Nick, what have you been consuming?
I went to a place called the Museum of Future Experiences in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And they have a show called Liminality, where you walk into a room that is dark and it has an incredible light setup as well as sound system. And for part of it, you wear VR goggles. And it's six immersive experiences Some are virtual reality, some are sound and light baths. And it was really pretty cool. It was like, the stories are kind of linked together, and liminality refers to being between two states where something is ending and another is beginning, but you're not exactly sure what's going to happen. You know, a pandemic is a liminal space. And it was a really interesting window into what might happen more in theater experiences, for instance. So the sound baths were generally pretty interesting. The VR segments were really well done compared to what I've seen in VR, similar things, you know, 4, 5, 10 years ago. So that's what I did. And I look forward to, I think, the future of a lot of entertainment, but especially stuff that you have to go out for, is going to be this kind of some type of immersive experience, you know, and some type of something different than what you can just watch on a screen.
If you go and ride the partially indoor, partially outdoor roller coaster at New York in Las Vegas,
right,
you can now rent a VR headset to experience a VR version of the roller coaster as you are riding it.
Oh, yeah.
That's like, some people don't come back from that.
I went to actually the the bougie version of this weekend, Nick. Mm-hmm. I went to the Van Gogh.
Oh, the immersive
installation, thing.
How did you like
that? I've been meaning to go to that for a long time because, again, it's like you've seen most of the Van Gogh paintings, you know, at least in reproduced form. But is it interesting? Does it yield fun?
It's pretty good. It's, it's like a little cheesy. It's mm-hmm. like a little bit cheesy, but genuinely immersive. Like you really do kind of sink down into it. And I wasn't prepared for how dark it was going to be. Like, I mean, I knew that Van Gogh's life is obviously a dark tale, but the kind of ecstatic beauty from paranoid psychosis and horrific depression thing, like they really hit that note pretty hard. And when you are immersed in that note, you come out a little shell-shocked.
Nick, any microdose pairings that you could recommend for the liminal spaces?
I did think that the whole experience.
Oh,
I
think I would do a macrodose there, okay. You know. But as it happened, none, and it was. But it was enjoyable and more of a promissory note than a full delivery on what the future is going to look like. But it's more interesting than a lot of conventional entertainment.
Speaking of conventional entertainment, Peter, I hear that that Spielberg fella,
yeah,
has got a new movie there. Did you watch it? You liked it?
I did. I saw West Side Story, the Spielberg reboot, reimagination, reimagining, I guess, with a new book by Tony Kushner, the playwright who wrote Angels in America, has also written some Spielberg films, Munich and Lincoln. And this is Spielberg's best movie in years. I absolutely loved it. It's just a marvel. I don't even really particularly like musicals all that much, although I did play these songs on the sousaphone as part of a marching band routine in high school. So the music was like...
You did Officer Krupke on a sousaphone?
Not solo. There were about 200 other kids.
His answer was
that's pretty amazing.
Solo.
But yes, obviously I played the tuba part in a marching band version of Officer Krupke. No, it's just so wonderful. And what's great about it is that Steven Spielberg is absolutely the greatest stager of cinematic set pieces in history. And like, so if you are a person who knows anything about movies, you can remember an image or two, if not like a whole sequence from a Spielberg movie, right? Like the bicycle, the E.T. bicycle across the moon, the T-Rex foot stomp as it's approaching the Jeeps in the middle of Jurassic Park, something there, right? Like you can remember just a little bit of Jaws. Almost everyone has some...
John Belushi's Japanese impersonations
sure.
in 1941.
Most people, I think, go directly to 1941. That's the popular choice. But
that's
almost everyone...
It's all downhill from there.
Has some bit of Spielbergianness burned into their brain somehow or another, and we all kind of just are like living in a collective Spielbergian consciousness here. And this movie just shows
so
how...
So what's the one? What was the set piece that you'll take away from West Side Story?
So I would say the gym sequence in particular, and there is just this incredibly both super elaborate and not quite showy bit where the camera follows some of the characters into the gym and then like basically steps onto a crane and everybody in the gym is doing this super elaborate dance in these crazy super hyper colored dresses and suits. And the camera just sort of floats, manages to both walk into the gym and then float over it, because basically what they did was they had a guy with a Steadicam step onto a Technicrane platform. And then anyway, it's just... And it's just such a wonderful bit of motion and of pure cinema. Forget whether you like the music or whatever. The music is, in fact, great. Forget whether the story is meaningful or how it references Romeo and Juliet. And like even the Tony Kushner stuff, which is kind of interesting about how it's about ethnic assimilation, right? He has pushed the story more in that direction. This is just an incredibly masterful piece of image and sound set together in a way that like you just don't see, even if you go see 50 movies a year, you don't see it very often. Spielberg's better than just about anybody at this stuff. And it's a reminder that all of his action scenes for so many decades basically are just borrowing from big Broadway musical numbers. And you see that most especially, I think, in the opening sequence where they're chasing the diamond in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, but all of these things are so just sort of like wonderfully mechanized and over the top. And so it's, he's a natural fit for the musical genre, and it's a great movie. And I would encourage anybody
what were
who
the updates?
They like Big Blast.
What were the updates? I mean, is it still
the Puerto Ricans now speak
trash,
a lot more. Yeah. So the Puerto Ricans now speak a lot more, Spanish, and, there's some swearing and sort of, it's just a little grittier, right? I mean, and it's also much more explicitly about the cycle of violence between, you know, sort of an intergenerational cycle of violence. Tony Kushner also wrote Munich, which was built around many of the same themes. And it's clear that he and Spielberg, when they collaborate, are really focused on sort of thinking about how violence moves between groups across generations and is sort of tragic and unsolvable.
So I, too, watched West Side Story, except it was a different version. I don't want to say superior because I haven't seen Spielberg yet, and I tend to like that guy.
You watched the brown face version, the original big Hollywood version with Natalie Wood?
I will never be able to get through that. As I've mentioned here before, it's unwatchable for me. I've tried several times. I can't get over the snapping. And the way they pass the basketball, just I can't, like, it's insurmountable for me. However, I watched one from April 1978 on a television special by Cher.
Oh, wow.
This was shared by Emily Nussbaum, the TV critic or movie critic, TV critic at New Yorker. I had no idea this existed. It was one of those hour-long celebrity variety specials. And Cher starts it off by a nearly 13-minute version of West Side Story in which she plays all the characters. And they superimpose her to make sort of group scenes, and she's in different costumes. And
is it just like Cher as Remy?
Cher is everybody. Yeah. It is.
Is it an Armenian gang, Matt, in that, or... Do they change the ethnicities?
No, they don't.
No?
No, they don't. And Cher is showing her actorial range at the time. It's just marvelous. It's a reminder of why Nick and I are eternally poisoned from our childhood and adolescence of the crazy stuff that, late inflation era was producing for us. It's just great. Go check it out. It's on YouTube. We'll do a link to it. But the special as a whole, I haven't yet watched. But it sounds so promising. Here's a description of the end of it from Wikipedia. The final segment is a big production number with a medley of songs performed by Cher, Dolly Parton, and the Tubes. Described as a musical battle to save Cher's soul medley, the Tubes try to lead her astray to the dark world of evil and sin, while Dolly Parton and several gospel singers try to save her and show her the light. Forget Nick Gillespie and microdosing. We were dosing by watching television back in 1978.
Do you think like white punks on dope show up in that medley, Matt?
I think they're implied.
Yeah.
You know, we'd leave things off screen. Nick,
Fee Waybill and Prairie Prince and Caleb Quay.
Yeah. OMG. It's terrific. And it's also, and I hate to say this because it sounds mean, but it's not intended that at all, but it makes me lament plastic surgery in this world, because Cher was a very expressive and strikingly beautiful actor and woman in the 70s. Miss that face. Anyways, speaking of inappropriate endings, we're going to end this here podcast. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Listen to all of our podcasts at Reason.com podcasts. And reminder that all of this here Reason content is made possible by your donations. Again, thank you for all that Webathon generosity you show. You can please consider going to Reason.com/donate. And become a monthly sustaining member, as they say in the NPR world, helping along our 501c3 nonprofit. Okay, check out Reason interview with Nick Gillespie later and this week, and the Soho Roundtable business with Gene Epstein, and we shall see you next Monday. Goodbye.